return, two former astronauts who opposed the mission will join us to discuss the deadly risks these teenagers will face as they set out into space. At those words, all our smiles vanish. Sam and I exchange a grim look. He follows a space conspirator just like I do, and we can both guess what the astronauts are about to say. "They always have to interview the naysayers. It doesn't make them right," Dad says, aiming for a breezy tone even as the shakiness in his voice gives him away. "Let's see what else is on," I tell him. "The last thing we need is to sit here in fear, listening to all the dangers I'm about to encounter." He changes the channel to Breaking News Tonight just in time for a segment titled The 24, Why They Were Chosen. Show anchor Sanford Pierce is settled in at his sleek glass desk, hands folded as he addresses the audience. "From an Olympic medalist to the world's youngest tech titan, tonight we introduce you to the 24 teenagers who are setting out on a galaxy-spanning journey to change all of our lives." A montage begins, set to a cinematic score. The strangers from today's press conference return, but instead of a collection of faces, I now get to see snippets of them in action. A boy with dark skin and black curls leads an interviewer through a garage-turned office, proudly showing off the app he created to predict incoming earthquakes. A red-haired girl dressed in a white lab coat stands in the center of a formal room, while the man I recognize as King William V of England taps the sword against her left shoulder and then her right in some kind of ceremonial gesture. An Asian boy pilots a plane over the ocean, swerving past another incoming aircraft and calling out instructions to a co-pilot who looks a good decade his senior. And then someone familiar takes the screen, a tall, tan boy stepping up to a diving board. It's the Italian finalist, the one who tried to comfort me. Just as I'm peering closer, the footage fades, the montage ending on a split-screen image of me and Beckett Wolf. My cheeks heat up in self-consciousness. "Like most of you, we on the news team were especially curious about the American finalists, Beckett Wolf and Naomi Ardalan," Sanford Pierce says into the camera. "Since their names were revealed this morning, we had a chance to do some research on these two exemplary teens. Take a look." The images on the TV scroll back in time, back to the last Wagner World Science Fair. I'm caught off guard by the sight of my 15-year-old self. I look different. I look happy. My idol, Dr. Greta Wagner, enters the frame and hands me a gilded trophy. It's the moment forever memorialized in the framed photo on my desk, reminding me every day to work harder, to think big like Wagner. Last year, Naomi blew us away with her DNA editing solution, an experimental method of hacking into and correcting a patient's genomes. This year, she brings us another work of true ingenuity, the Ardalan Radio Telescope model, with its unique antenna and receiver design that would allow us to capture a clearer signal from other planets in our solar system. As Dr. Wagner unveils my blueprints on the screen, my parents and Sam cheer in real time, right along with their younger selves in the footage. I smile with them, though my pride is dampened by the fact that the telescope was never built. Same with my DNA editing solution, which I dreamed up for Sam. Once Earth entered the state of climate destruction, there were no more grants or funds left for anything that didn't relate to our immediate survival. "In fact," Dr. Wagner continues in the footage, "this is the kind of invention the folks at SETI would have jumped over themselves to use." The great inventor and engineer purses her lips, her eyes darkening, and I know the reason for her soured expression. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, was defunded 3 months before the Wagner Science Fair. The scientific community protested the loss, but there was no way around it. NASA and the government had deemed the search for extraterrestrial life non-essential in these desperate times. And that's precisely why the final six will be walking blindly into whatever is waiting on Europa. Because unlike every previous space mission, there is no SETI to rule out the possibility of life. My head snaps up. I've just given myself an idea. After saying goodnight to our parents, I grab my tablet and cross the hall from my pocket-sized bedroom into Sam's. I find him staring at a screen of his own, his brow furrowed with worry. "What's wrong? What are you looking at?" I pull up a chair beside him at the desk and he slides his laptop toward me. An article fills the screen with the headline reading, "Athena Backup Crew Warns of Europa Risks." At the center of the page is a photo of the surviving astronauts, hugging through their tears at the memorial for the doomed Athena crew 5 years ago. A chill creeps up my spine, and I quickly close the page. I know, I tried asking the NASA rep about it today, and she fed me the company line about how this mission will be completely different. But we have even more important things to talk about. Have you been on Space Conspirator today? Sam shakes his head and I log on to the site, which has a brand new landing page since this morning's announcement. Underneath the Conspirator logo is an artist's sketch of six shadowy puppets staring at a faceless creature rising up from the ocean, while a caricature of a man and woman, meant to represent the Europa mission leaders, pull the puppet strings. As Sam shudders, I click on the website's news tab and scroll, hunting for a certain article. That footage on TV gave me an idea, the part where Dr. Wagner mentioned SETI, I tell him. If I could prove it, if I could show the world that the space conspirators' claims aren't just the ravings of some renegade scientists, but the truth, well, that would change everything. It would bring me home. My cursor lands on the article I was looking for, Scientific Probabilities of Life in Europa's Oceans. The conspirator was right when it predicted the outcome of the Athena mission years ago. Why shouldn't it be right this time too, especially when science supports the theory? As my brother starts to read, I jump out of my chair, too fired up to sit still. I'll go to space training camp under the pretense of preparing for the Europa mission, but in reality, I'll be on a whole other mission of my own. I can use the Johnson Space Center tools at my disposal to finish the job that SETI never got to do. I'll conduct my own search for extraterrestrial intelligence, focused solely on Europa. Sam turns around in his seat, watching me with raised eyebrows. If I can prove the theory that there is a high probability of intelligent life waiting for us, that would completely turn public opinion of the mission on its head. I take a deep breath. There is just no way world leaders would send us if they believed what I do, especially when the president's own nephew is involved. A slow smile spreads across my brother's face. So, you're going to sabotage the mission from the inside? I prefer the term enlighten the public, but yeah. I grin. Certain people might call it sabotage. Sam reaches over to give me a fist bump. I like this plan. Go get him, sis.
5. Leo.
Leo! Leo! Forza Leo!
I pull back the curtains of the guest bedroom with a smile. It's just past 8 in the morning on departure day, but my neighbors are already here, waiting on the docks to see me off. The sight fills me with warmth, and I can't resist cranking open the window.
Vi amo tutti!
I call, waving at the faces below. And it's true. Right now, I love every last one of them standing there in the cold, cheering my name. My appearance at the window sends their cheers into overdrive, and I laugh to myself as I imagine what my sister would say. They do know it's you, right? Just then, a knock sounds at my door.
Leo, it's Dr. Schroeder. Are you up?
Come in, I call, and he steps inside, carrying a small trunk. I have something you'll need for the trip. The Europa mission leaders requested that all finalists arrive at International Space Training Camp already in uniform. He hands me the trunk, and as I lift the lid, my pulse begins to race. The first thing I see is a dark blue flight jacket, lined with wool, warmer and softer than any of the threadbare clothes I've been wearing since the Flood. The jacket is adorned with military-style patches, one bearing the ISTC logo, another with the logo of ESA, and a third patch emblazoned with my own name. The back of the jacket reads Mission Europa in striking bold letters. And for a moment, I can't speak. This is really happening. Beneath the jacket is a pair of khakis, some high-tech sneakers, and a blue ISTC polo shirt, glinting with a flash of gold. I take a second look. It's a golden pin of the Italian flag. My breath catches. I won't be leaving my country behind after all. I'll be wearing our colors proudly against my chest. I look up to meet Dr. Schroeder's eyes. It's perfect. Thank you. He grins. Glad you approve. See you downstairs in 20 minutes? I nod, adrenaline working its way through my body as the countdown begins. Stepping into the ISTC uniform and leaving Europe for the first time in my life seems almost like assuming a new identity. It's the second chance I never expected, even though a part of me still clings to who I used to be, when I was with my parents and with Angelica. I pull the polo shirt over my head and step into the khakis and sneakers, which are as comfortable as they look. I drape the Mission Europa jacket over my shoulders, and now I look the part. I am ready. The guards escort the Vincentis, Dr. Schroeder, and me to the Palazzo boat dock, where the crowd of onlookers breaks into a chorus of hurrahs at our arrival. I turn to Elena with a grin, and though she returns my smile, it doesn't quite reach her eyes. I can tell she's still preoccupied with last night's discovery, and I wish I could reassure her that it doesn't faze me. What matters isn't how I got picked. It's that I was chosen at all. There it is. The Prime Minister points straight ahead, where the boat's mast breaks the monotonous stretch of water. My heart lifts at the return of the vessel that saved and changed my life. Are you ready, Leo? Dr. Schroeder asks. I take one last look around me, at the sunken new face of Rome. Even in its wrecked state, there is still something beautiful about my homeland. I know I'll never forget the way it looks right now, the morning sun gleaming against the waves. Arrivederci, Roma, I murmur. And then I glance at Dr. Schroeder. Let's go. I've already said my goodbyes to the Vincentis inside, but just before I step onto the boat, Elena grabs my wrist. She flings her arms around me in one last hug before whispering in my ear. Remember everything I told you. Keep your eyes and ears open and your guard up. I will. Don't worry, Elena. But as I settle into my seat on the boat, watching my neighbors on the docks grow smaller, all I can think about is the adventure ahead. Elena's warnings are already forgotten. The sleek white Gulf Stream lowers in the sky toward us, its engine emitting an ear-splitting roar. Dr. Schroeder pulls me back, and the two of us duck as the jet slides onto the Tuscan airfield runway in a perfect landing. Did I tell you, I've never been on an airplane before? I shout above the noise. Dr. Schroeder's eyebrows shoot up. It's true, I say with a chuckle. We never had the money for transcontinental travel, so all our family trips were by train within Europe. He places a hand on my shoulder. And now you might be one of the few to travel farther than anyone else on this earth. The thought sends a flash of excitement through me. The farther I get from Rome, the more I want this, and the harder it is to imagine ever returning. The jet parks on the concrete before us. Its automatic doors slide open, and a set of stairs unfurls from them. Our pilot, a captain from the Italian army, steps outside to greet Dr. Schroeder and me, ushering us into the compact passenger cabin where we take our seats. It's so much more personal than it looks on TV, I comment to Dr. Schroeder. Yeah, well, those big commercial airliners are a thing of the past, he says grimly. Now that more than half of the world's tourist destinations are underwater, there's no need for them. This generation of kids growing up will likely never experience air travel, unless they work for the government or military. Speaking of, am I now considered part of the Italian army? I ask, since I've technically been drafted. You are representing Italy, but as part of a new world army, Dr. Schroeder explains. It's all of us fighting together now, fighting to save the human race. I nod, trying to appear calm, even as his words push my anticipation into overdrive. We're cleared for takeoff, the captain's voice echoes over the loudspeaker. Please ensure your seatbelts are fastened. Copy that, Dr. Schroeder calls back. I grip my armrest as the jet lurches forward, and then, like a thrill ride from the old amusement parks, we hurtle up into the sky at breakneck speed. The cabin shakes as the plane skims the clouds, my stomach flipping over with each pitch of the aircraft. Are flights usually this bumpy? Dr. Schroeder shifts in his seat to face me, looking almost as queasy as I feel. They didn't used to be. It's another one of climate change's side effects. The warming temperatures strengthen the jet stream winds and turn the skies hostile. But believe it or not, we're safer up here than we are down there.
I believe it.
I turned to the window, keeping my eyes locked on the glass to distract from the bumps and dips of the plane, and soon I've lost track of how much time has elapsed. It isn't until the anxiety presses against my chest that I realize I'm waiting for something that isn't coming. A break from the blue. The endless ocean dominates my view, overwhelming the dots of green and tiny slivers of land. You can see it clearly from up here. Why this mission is so crucial, Dr. Schroeder says, following my gaze. Not long ago, when you were a child, the scenery below was vastly different. The scientists and climatologists tried to warn the public about the risks of carbon emissions and pollution, but... He shakes his head. Well, it's too late now, and we don't have much time left if we're going to escape the rising seas. No, I agree, staring at the foreboding stretch of blue. We don't have much time at all.
Naomi. It seems like all of Los Angeles is on the tarmac at Burbank Airport, watching as my heart breaks. I hold on to my family, trying to block out the noise and the pressure, as the crowd shrieks my name, flashing their camera phones and waving signs proclaiming the 24, our last chance for survival. Only a few minutes remain until the NASA official and Army major will come tear me away from my family. Dad pulls the three of us into a tight-knit group hug, and I bury my head in his shoulder, hiding my face. Naomi, Azizem, we're gonna miss you more than we can bear, he says in my ear, his voice choked with tears. But we know you weren't born for this planet. You were meant for something bigger. He's right. Mom cradles my chin in her hands. As much as I want you beside me, you have too much to offer to stay in a world that's failing you. Go out there and change the universe. I would if I could, but... My words falter as I watch my little brother wipe his eyes on his sleeve. Maybe in another life I would have leaped at this opportunity, but not now, not with my heart pulling me toward home. As if reading my thoughts, Mom adds, don't forget, if you make the final six and the mission succeeds, then the three of us are guaranteed a seat on the first human settlement spacecraft to Europa. She gives me a shaky smile. So you see, we can all be together again, but in a better place. I meet Sam's eyes, and I know we're both thinking the same thing. Mom is an eternal optimist, but whether the mission will succeed is a gigantic if. And even if it does, my brother's heart could never withstand a rocket launch into space. And there's no way anyone else is leaving him behind. So no, there won't be a fairy tale reunion for the four of us on Europa. Not a chance. Still, I force myself to nod along with her words, to let her hold on to hope. But then Sam is in front of me and I can't say goodbye to him. I can't. I choke on the words. I love you, sis. It's gonna be okay. He lowers his voice. You're gonna go to Houston and show everyone what's possible, what's really out there. And then you'll come home. He looks at me hopefully. Right? Right, I whisper back. I reach into the pocket of my Mission Europa jacket and hand him a folded square of paper. To read when you need me. Sam smiles at me through his tears. Our telepathy game remains strong. My eyes well up all over again as he reaches into his coat pocket and hands me an envelope of his own. But instead of just a letter, I feel something small and bulky inside. Keep it safe. Sam gives me a warning look and I nod, stashing the envelope in the front pocket of my backpack. Naomi, let's go. I turn sharply at the sound of Dr. Anderson's voice. It's too soon. I'm not ready. But now the army officers are approaching. The jet doors are sliding open. The plane's engine is revving. I'm running out of time. I reach for my parents once more. Take care of my brother. Take care of each other. I love you all so much. I get in one last hug with Sam before Dr. Anderson and Major Lewis's hands are on my shoulders, pulling me away from my family and ushering me into a new life. I peer through the jet window, watching as an island of concrete materializes below. This must be it. Space City, Houston. The land that gave us the Apollo missions and the International Space Station that launched a million childhood daydreams, including mine. When my mom showed a 6-year-old me the historic video of Anousheh Ansari climbing inside the Soyuz rocket, becoming the first Iranian-American woman in space, I remember instantly picturing myself in her place. That's what I want to do, I told mom then, brimming with confidence. Me and Sam can be the first brother-sister duo in orbit. Even then, I never wanted to leave him. So once I learned the truth about Sam's condition, that it would preclude him from ever venturing beyond our Earth, I dropped the astronaut dream like a bad habit. And now the childhood wish is coming true, in spite of me. We'll be touching down any minute, Dr. Anderson says from her seat beside me. Do you want to freshen up for the cameras? I shrug. Not really. At this point, looking attractive for strangers is the very last item on my priority list. Dr. Anderson gives me a hint of a smile. You might want to tighten your seatbelt for this. The changing topography and climate in Texas have made landing extra turbulent here. How did you guys manage to keep Houston above sea level when the Gulf of Mexico swallowed other parts of Texas? I ask as I tug my seatbelt tighter. Was it all because of the Houston Flood Barrier Project? And why didn't other cities do the same? My mind flashes back to the submerged Santa Monica Pier back home and the old coastal communities of Venice Beach and Marina del Rey, now nothing more than an endless blue graveyard. I wonder if they might have been saved too. It took an eye-watering amount of money to build the flood barrier gates, Dr. Anderson acknowledges. The only reason we were able to do it is because at the UN climate conference, back when the first indisputable signs of the change began, Houston was chosen as the site to protect and preserve at all costs. With the greatest minds, from Stephen Hawking to Elon Musk insisting that the only way forward for humans was to colonize new planets, it was clear to the UN that all resources needed to go toward the best space training and launch program in the world. That would be here. That's why budgets were cut everywhere else, I realize aloud. All the money is going toward getting us off Earth, instead of protecting the people on it. Dr. Anderson gives me a sideways look. NASA doesn't see it that way. The fact is, we have limited resources and we're facing a dying planet. We can either spread ourselves thin and make little impact, or we can focus all efforts on the Europa mission and have a real shot at success. It's obvious Dr. Anderson's been drinking the mission Kool-Aid. While I can somewhat follow her logic, I feel a wave of fury at the thought of all the people who told me no these past 2 years. No money for the genome surgery to fix Sam's heart, no grant for my radio telescope, no to so many things that could have improved the world for the living. They better hope and pray Europa is the miracle they've built it up to be. Here we go, Dr. Anderson says over my shoulder as the jet shudders downward, giving us a clear view of the Houston cityscape, with still-standing skyscrapers connected by a network of skywalks. And then, my temporary new home appears in the near distance, the sprawling campus of Johnson Space Center. Something else we did to preserve the Space Center was elevate the buildings and move all facilities to the uppermost floors. Dr. Anderson comments, nodding at the window. This way, even when the storms come, our staff and equipment should remain mostly safe. The plane takes another swoop, and I grab the sides of my seat as the air sends us rocking and jerking toward a large runway spread out below us, the Ellington Field. But I've never seen a runway like this, teeming with people. While half the tarmac is like an airplane parking lot, with a row of small jets stationed side by side, the other half might as well be a stage. A dozen figures stand opposite the planes, dressed in the same uniform as me and surrounded by a cluster of photographers, cheering spectators, and an actual marching band. As our jet skids to the ground, I hear the faint strains of, "You're a grand old flag." That's for you, Dr. Anderson says with a smile. My heartbeat picks up speed, my stage fright returning with a vengeance. Dr. Anderson unbuckles her seatbelt and retrieves my carry-on luggage, but I stay put. I'm nowhere near ready. Go on, she says, touching my shoulder. You can do this. I'll be right behind you, though you probably won't see me again after today. I can hear the drum roll coming from the marching band, the shouts of my name from the crowd, and I swallow hard. She's right. I can do this. Besides, I have no choice. I stand up, lift my chin, and make the shaky walk to the front of the plane. The door juts open, the stairs unfurl. And as I appear at the top of the steps, the band launches into the Star-Spangled Banner. Cameras flash in wild succession, and my fellow finalists assembled at the center of the tarmac all look up to stare at me. Standing in front of them are the mission leaders, the same pair the space conspirator depicted as holding the puppet strings. Dr. Takumi from NASA and General Sokolov of Roscosmos, the Russian space agency. Beyond the barricades of the airbase, hundreds of onlookers swarm, some even hopping to the top of the fence as they wave flags from the different represented countries, their faces almost manic as they scream a chant. God bless the 24, for they are our only hope! A knot forms in the pit of my stomach. If this collection of strangers pinning their hopes on us is representative of the world, then that means millions are depending on the success of the 24. But don't they realize all the risks involved with the mission? Don't they know that we're just glorified guinea pigs forced to perform under Murphy's Law, which practically guarantees something going horribly wrong in space or on Europa? No, of course they don't. Without doing the research, there's no way to know the risks. Maybe they don't even want to know. Dr. Anderson gives me a slight push, and I make my way down the airplane steps. When we reach the foot of the stairs, she takes my arm, steering me to the mission leaders. Dr. Takumi, Solar System Ambassador and the President of International Space Training Camp, moves forward first. Something about his presence causes me to take an involuntary step back. Maybe it's his stature, which requires me to crane my neck to meet his eyes. Or maybe it's his eyes themselves, which have a fierce glint to them, even as his lips form a thin smile. His head is shaved, highlighting his sharp features and the lines creasing his face. As he looks at me and extends a hand, I think of the puppet master on the Space Conspirator homepage, and a shiver runs through me. "Welcome, Naomi, to International Space Training Camp," he says, his voice deep and authoritative. "I am Dr. Ren Takumi, and this is General Irina Sokolov, the commanding general of the Europa mission." "Nice to meet you," I reply, my throat feeling like sandpaper. While Dr. Takumi wears a black variation of our uniform, his second-in-command is dressed in red, the color of the Russian space program. General Sokolov's auburn hair is cropped in a pixie cut, and her brown eyes are intent as she studies me. "Congratulations on making the 24, Naomi," she greets me. "I hope you're prepared to work hard." "Yes, thank you." I glance up at the sound of another jet overhead, and Dr. Takumi points me to the line of arrivals. "Please join your fellow finalists, and once everyone is here, we will proceed to the Space Center." I can feel my heart thumping loudly in my chest as I approach the others. What are they like? Will I get along with them? Is this going to be at all bearable? I recognize a couple of their faces from the news segments, particularly my fellow American, Beckett Wolf, who stands at the end of the line. I fill the empty space beside him, just as a jet nearly identical to mine swoops down. "Hi, I'm Naomi," I half-yell over the sound of the plane. "You're Beckett, right?" Beckett turns and peers down his nose at me. He points to the name sewn across the pocket of his jacket uniform. "Obviously." "Ew. Let's hope the other finalists aren't anything like the first nephew, who rolls his eyes as he turns away from me. I can see it written clearly on his face, his disdain for the two-ethnic, non-celebrity he's forced to share the American spotlight with. "Sorry, dude. I didn't ask to be here." As the next jet hits the ground, the marching band transitions into a pulsating new song, swapping their snare drums for a pair of tablas. The music is electric, the melody beautiful, and as an Indian boy with a mile-wide grin steps off the plane, I'm surprised to feel myself getting caught up in the spectacle, joining in the crowd's applause. There is something powerful in the seamless transition from one country's music to another, in the sight of so many different flags waving together in the wind, and my chest swells with unexpected emotion. The Indian finalist, Dev Khanna, joins me in line, and I can tell right away that he's much friendlier than Beckett. He returns my smile, and we share a quick handshake before the band segues into its next song. Another plane touches down, its wings painted in the colors of the Italian flag. Italy. That means it's the boy from the video conference, the one who tried to comfort me. I stand up a little straighter as Leonardo Danieli emerges from the jet. His face lights up at the sight of all of us, at the sound of the music from his country, and he half dances down the steps of the plane. I can't help but grin as I watch him. Our eyes meet for a split second. I can tell he recognizes me too. And in that moment, his smile seems to grow.
Leo. It feels like I'm living someone else's life as I take in the scene on the tarmac. It's too thrilling, too awe-inspiring to actually be happening to me. Adrenaline surges through my veins as I stand with the rest of the 24, listening to Dr. Takumi deliver a speech for the cameras, broadcasting us live to the world. Today marks the start of mankind's most important step. The very step that will secure our future. His voice rings out across the airfield. On behalf of the 6 space agencies and our staff at ISTC, we are delighted to welcome the most extraordinary teenagers from around the world to our campus at Johnson Space Center. We combed the globe to find these unique individuals standing before you, all of whom possess the strength, smarts, and youth necessary to achieve our highest aim. And I'm one of them. It still seems unthinkable that I made it this far, especially compared to the geniuses all around me. From the get-go, the Europa mission's stringent prerequisites kept the draft pool relatively low. Our finalists were required to be between the ages of 16 and 19, with clean bills of health and near-perfect vision. Their bodies needed to meet the anthropometric requirements for long-duration spacesuits, while their minds had to test above the 85th percentile for IQ. They were also required to speak fluent English, the home language of space training camp, in addition to their native tongue. Yet even with all these boxes to tick, we were still able to select finalists who brought something else, something unique to the table. It must be my imagination, but I could swear Dr. Takumi is looking straight at me as he says those last words. In the coming weeks, we will train, challenge, and test the 24, both physically and mentally, to prepare them for a life in space. This training period will help us carefully evaluate each finalist and ensure that we choose the right team of 6, he continues. One day, years from now, this mission will be taught in schools. It will be known as the defining moment for the continuation of the human race. But those future students won't be learning about it here on Earth. Dr. Takumi pauses, a ghost of a smile on his face. They will study the mission from their new schools, their new homes, on Europa. The crowd roars, the onlookers whooping and rattling the fence surrounding the airfield in their exhilaration as Dr. Takumi gives credence to our deepest, wildest hopes. It all starts now. He lets out a piercing whistle, and suddenly 2 open-air trolleys come rolling toward us, driven by men in U.S. Army camouflage. Dr. Takumi and General Sokolov jump onto separate vehicles as Takumi calls out his first official command. Finalists, come aboard. I make a beeline for Dr. Takumi's trolley, and I sprint past the other competitors to land a seat up front. Maybe it's silly of me to take the ride so seriously, but I'm determined to seize any FaceTime I can get with the key figure deciding my fate. The trolley rumbles forward, leaving Ellington Field behind and heading onto a main street. It's my first time seeing sidewalks and stoplights again, and I glance around in shock, feeling like I've traveled back to the past, to when the world was normal. Of course, there's nothing normal about riding in a motorcade, with a marching band in the trolley behind us playing a medley of national anthems from our represented countries. When the Chinese national anthem transitions into my own, it's like hearing from an old friend. I smile up at the sky. Our motorcade turns onto NASA Parkway, and I draw in a sharp breath. If I thought I'd seen crowds in Rome, or even just minutes ago on the tarmac, that was nothing compared to the hordes lining these blocks in the sweltering heat. They brandish flags and posters. They jump up and down in hysterics as our procession passes, some in tears, others shouting out good luck in multiple languages. I can feel what each stranger on the sidewalk is thinking. Please let this work. Let them save us. The trolley pulls through an open gate, and our group cheers as the Johnson Space Center sign looms before us. The campus is vast as a city and protected like a fortress, with barricades on all sides to hold back the rising tides. We pass dozens of numbered buildings and bunkers before the trolley stops at the largest one, Building 9. 2 flags soar above it, one featuring the American Stars and Stripes for NASA, the other bearing the international logo of the ISTC. Dr. Takumi jumps off the trolley first, and we follow him to the front steps as the photographers and reporters on our tail clamor for one last good shot.
Wave goodbye, Dr. Takumi instructs, as the 24 of us gather before him and General Sokolov. This is the last time anyone outside of training camp will get to see you until the first round of eliminations.
First round? My palms begin to sweat. I glance at my fellow finalists, gauging their reactions. Some of them are beaming for the cameras and waving, while others can't hide their nerves. But as I scan the group, I realize I'm looking for someone in particular. The American from the video conference. The girl whose sadness struck me that day. When I finally spot her, I notice she is mouthing something to the cameras, her dark eyes urgent. What is she trying to say? I take a step closer to her, just as the doors to Building 9 fly open, and Dr. Takumi beckons us inside. This is it. My pulse quickens as we follow Dr. Takumi, leaving the old world behind.
6. Naomi. I turn around for one last look before the doors close behind us, cutting me off from any semblance of normal life. I can feel the gravity of this place pulling me farther away from Sam and my parents, and for a moment, my feet refuse to move. And then a girl with chin-length dark hair and a nose ring elbows me in the ribs, muttering, "Hurry up," and I force myself into motion, following the pack of finalists down a long hallway. Dr. Takumi and General Sokolov bring us to a halt in front of the elevator bay, where framed, autographed photos of astronauts from the past adorn the walls. I move closer, my heartbeat picking up speed at the image of Sally Ride upside down in zero gravity, at Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko stepping into the Soyuz. It's surreal to think we're standing within the same walls where, ages ago, these legends were made. I wonder what they would think of the Europa mission, if they too would balk at the risks. "Armstrong shouldn't have to share a wall with that guy," Beckett Wolf comments to no one in particular, making a face at the portrait of Yuri Gagarin hanging beside Neil Armstrong's. There was just no one at his level in those days. I cringe, dying to correct him, but not quite in the mood to draw attention to myself. Thankfully, there are other finalists here eager to school him. "You do know Yuri Gagarin was the first human in space, right?" interjects a boy I recognize from the TV segment on the 24. "Jian from China, I remember, the pilot." "Sure, but the goal of the space race was to get to the moon," Beckett says, drawing out the word to prove his point, "not to just chill out in orbit. That's why we won." "Yuri Gagarin was a hero," General Sokolov steps in, narrowing her eyes at Beckett. "I'd hardly refer to his landmark achievement as chilling out." That shuts Beckett right up. I meet Jian's eyes and we exchange a grin. I have a feeling this will be the perfect place for the first nephew to overcome his superiority complex. The general leads half of us into one of the oversized elevators and up to the third floor, where we reconvene with Dr. Takumi and the rest of the finalists in a stark white corridor, with signs pointing the way to the Space Center auditorium. I recognize the gray-carpeted theater as soon as we walk inside, with its array of flags framing a curved stage. This is the setting of every historic NASA press conference I've seen on screen, only this time the audience seats are empty, waiting for us to fill them. A group of adults in ISTC uniforms mills about on stage, a hush falling over them as we enter with Dr. Takumi. "Take your seats in the first two rows," he instructs us, before sweeping up the steps and onto the stage. I sit between a boy with wavy brown hair and a lopsided grin, who introduces himself as Callum Turner from Australia, and the girl with the nose ring and lilting accent, Ana Martinez from Spain. "Nice to meet you," I whisper to the two of them before Dr. Takumi steps up to the podium, harnessing everyone's attention with his direct gaze. "Finalists, welcome to your new home and training grounds. Joining me on stage are the ISTC faculty, made up of the top minds in aerospace and science, who will be preparing you for the mission ahead," he announces. "We'll begin by dividing you into four teams of six. Each team will be overseen by one of our faculty, experienced, retired astronauts known as team leaders, who will serve as your chaperone and guide throughout this process. Meanwhile, your teammates are the finalists you'll be training and spending most of your time with here, and you will be evaluated on how well you work together and get along. We've put careful thought and consideration into each team to encourage a spirit of both competition and cooperation. It's like the first day of school, but with fatal consequences. I shift uncomfortably in my seat, wondering which of these strangers I'll be stuck with. As Dr. Takumi launches into staff introductions, my uneasiness gives way to interest. These are no ordinary teachers. They are a mix of scientists, engineers, and former astronauts from around the world, combined with sergeants and lieutenants from the United States Army. Looking at the faculty in front of us, it's clear that we're in for the space travel equivalent of boot camp. Of course, I saved the best for last, he continues, looking down the line of his staff with a secretive smile. Not long ago, the world watched as we sent two humanoid robots on a flyby probe of Europa to gather data and confirm the habitability of Jupiter's moon. The success of that first mission is the reason you are all sitting here today. Dr. Takumi pauses for effect. Since the robots have already proven themselves indispensable and have a first-hand knowledge of Europa, they will be accompanying the final six on the mission. My mouth falls open. No way, I whisper to Anna beside me as the room buzzes with excited murmurs. We all know which robots he's talking about. We followed their progress religiously, the same way our parents geeked out over the Mars Curiosity rover before us. And the thought of traveling through space with them is like a fantasy beyond anything my childhood self could have dreamed up. Without further ado, I'm proud to introduce you to the most advanced artificial intelligence currently in existence, Sib and Dot. The curtain drops to reveal two majestic machines. They are the size and shape of humans, with terrestrial legs and dexterous fingers, but their bodies are encased in shells of machinery, like powered suits of armor. Dot's body is bronze and Sib's is platinum, denoting their difference in status, while their faces are masks of metal with a pair of round blue camera lenses for eyes. Sliding plates on each of their torsos reveal a digital tablet, the wand that activates the magic of AIOS, the Artificial Intelligence Operating System. I'm practically salivating at the sight of it. And as the robots march to the front of the stage, I can't help rising to my feet, leading the room in a spontaneous standing ovation. I know all the work that went into creating such exceptional AIs, the complex algorithms and encoders that gave Dot and Sib their brains, the hundreds of sensors and dozens of power PC processors that make up their guts, and I feel a twinge of longing. To get to learn from these robots and one day develop artificial intelligence of my own, that's a dream that gets my blood flowing. I just don't want to have to leave the planet in order to achieve it. The robots turn to give Dr. Takumi and General Sokolov a formal salute, and the general crosses the stage to join them. Sib has been programmed to autopilot the spacecraft to Europa and will therefore serve as my proxy commander, she reveals. Dot will provide backup support. Because of their importance on this mission and their ability to form unbiased opinions based on logic, the robots will join Dr. Takumi and myself in deciding the first eliminations. Which brings us to our next piece of news. She glances at Dr. Takumi, and he nods for her to continue. Right now, the abandoned Athena supply ship is still orbiting Mars and carrying with her 2 decades' worth of preserved food and resources. By including a Mars rendezvous on your trajectory to Europa, we're able to not only salvage some of the billions invested in the Athena mission, but more importantly, provide for all of your needs on Jupiter's moon. There's just one problem. She lets out a long exhale. Based on this week's images and data from SATCON, we have reason to suspect a fuel leak. My eyebrows shoot up. That would mean, without a human crew to patch the leak, the supply ship will eventually run out of fuel, and tidal forces will pull her out of orbit. The general's voice echoes my grim thoughts. Luckily, that process takes time, but not long enough for us to have the luxury of 4 months of training. That's why we're moving up the Europa launch to 1 month from now, Dr. Takumi announces to the sound of our gasps. Likewise, your training will be compressed into a more rigorous 4-week course. It may sound daunting, but with Sib and Dot joining you on the mission, that amount of training should be sufficient. You won't be entirely alone up there. I feel my throat closing up in panic as the shock of his words reverberates through the room. 1 month? How can anyone be ready that quickly, to have to leave Earth so soon? Meanwhile, he adds, half of you will be eliminated from the draft in 2 weeks' time. Judging by the aghast expressions I see all around me, most of my fellow finalists have zero desire to go home so early. but the thought sends hope flooding through my chest. While the others are busy trying to impress the robots, I can make a point of falling below their radar, presenting myself as a perfectly average, elimination-worthy candidate. And then I'd be safe from Europa. In just 2 weeks, I could be on my way home. Except, there's the not-so-small matter of the promise I made to my brother and to myself. I have a theory to prove first, and succeeding would mean that I can ensure all of us get to return safely to our families. Pulling this off before the first elimination will be a major stretch, but I have to at least try. Now, let me address the elephant in the room. Dr. Takumi's voice takes on a warning tone, pulling me out of my thoughts and back into the present. We are well aware that some of you might be tempted to sabotage or diminish your co-finalists in order to advance your own standing in the draft. The ISTC has a zero-tolerance policy where this is concerned, and anyone who attempts it will face severe punishment. I stifle a laugh. They certainly don't need to worry about that with me. Others among you may have the opposite aim. Some of you might try to play down your abilities, to sabotage your own chances. Dr. Takumi's eyes move across the room, studying each one of us, and my face turns hot. You should know that we can see right through any of these attempts, he continues. The 24 of you will be closely monitored, both during training and in regular psychological evaluations. If we find you guilty of self-sabotage or attempting to thwart one of your teammates, you will be punished accordingly. Lesser infractions will require you and your family to pay a steep fine, while larger crimes carry the same sentence as resisting the draft, long-term imprisonment. The room is dead silent now. Fear churns in my stomach as I realize the risks I'll be taking with my plan. But it's not impossible, a voice in my head whispers. I can still investigate and expose the mission from the inside. I'll just have to outsmart a bunch of brilliant adults and two AIs in order to do it. Great. And now, without further ado, let's assign your teams. Dr. Takumi smiles broadly, a jarring transition from his talk of crimes and jail time. First up is Team Lark. A young woman bounds to the front of the stage, tall and willowy, with dark skin and braided black hair. She must be in her 20s, unusually young for a retired astronaut, and I find myself wondering what her story is. When I call your name, please come up to the stage and form a line behind Lark, Dr. Takumi instructs. First on the team is Asher Levin from Israel. A boy in the row before me jolts out of his seat. I watch as he makes his way up to the stage, raking a hand through his auburn hair, the expression behind his glasses a mixture of pride and nerves. From Singapore, Suki Chuan. There's a shuffling a few seats down from me as Suki slides out of our row. She walks up the steps with her head held high, a look of steely determination in her eyes, the picture of poise. I have a feeling I'll look like a bumbling deer in headlights in comparison when my own name is called. Next, from the United States, Beckett Wolf. Beckett strides up to the stage with a smirk, barely mustering eye contact with Asher and Suki while shaking their hands. I don't envy those two getting lumped into his team. And, also from the United States, Naomi Ardalan. What? My head jerks up in surprise. Why would they put both American finalists on the same team? I can tell my counterpart is thinking the same thing, as his smile twists into something sour. The first nephew clearly doesn't appreciate having another American here to steal his thunder. Go on, Callum whispers beside me, and I push out of my seat, forcing a deep breath as all eyes in the room momentarily focus on me. I climb up to the stage, even as I'm itching to run in the opposite direction, and take my place beside Beckett. Hey, Asher leans over and offers me a handshake, while Suki gives me a tentative smile. I smile back at them, relieved to have a couple of friendlier faces on my team. Just two more to go for Team Lark, Dr. Takumi continues, and I brace myself, wondering who will be joining us next. From Italy, Leonardo Danieli. Him. My spirits lift as the boy from the video conference grins and makes his way toward us. Something tells me this team will be a little more bearable with him on it. Ciao, he says, a charming dimple appearing in his cheek as he shakes my hand. You can call me Leo. Hi, Leo. I hold his gaze a second longer than I should, almost missing the announcement of our last team member, Katerina Federin from Russia, a former Olympic figure skater. As she joins us, Dr. Takumi nods in satisfaction at the sight of our completed team. The six of you may be excused. Lark, please show your finalists to their room and common areas. All right, team. Lark turns to face us. Let's get this show on the road. The grand tour begins on the fifth floor, which Lark refers to as the Hab, the place where we will sleep, eat, and spend all of our downtime between training. The elevator doors open onto a blue carpeted corridor, and we follow Lark as she leads the way to the first stop, the cafeteria. We'll meet here every morning for breakfast at 7 a.m., she says as we step through the automatic glass doors. Lunch is a quicker, on-the-go meal provided for you in between your training sessions, and then we'll return here for dinner in the evenings at 6:30. You'll find there's one thing in particular you don't have to worry about at space training camp. She winks. Rationing. What do you mean? I blurt out. I don't dare get my hopes up, but if she's saying what I think she is... The government agreed to waive all ration restrictions for the 24, she replies. Since, after all, anyone making the journey into space needs to be in peak condition. So, you may get homesick, but you'll never go hungry. I meet the eyes of my fellow finalists, nearly all of them looking as gleeful as I feel at the prospect of eating until our bellies are full. I know I can't get used to this, that I'll be back to living on canned soup and bread when my prayer is answered and I make it back home, but I can have my fill while I'm here. The thought has me practically lightheaded with anticipation. We'll eat meals as a team right here, Lark continues, tapping her knuckles on one of the long folding tables filling the center of the cafeteria. She points to the now empty buffet counter, which snakes around the back of the room. Each day's menu alternates between the different cuisines of our represented countries. Tonight, you have a choice of both American and Chinese food. A choice? That's almost as unbelievable as no rations. I catch Leo peering around the cafeteria wide-eyed, and my stomach growls in solidarity. Lark leads us to the library next, and I feel my body begin to relax at the comforting sight of the stacks, at the nostalgic scent of leather-bound books. Libraries have always been my happy place. And as long as I have one I can escape to here, well, I just might survive whatever is thrown at me. What's the deal with the Wi-Fi? Beckett asks, eyeing the row of desktop computers. Internet access is only available to finalists here in the library, Lark answers. We have a list of pre-approved websites you can access, and online video chatting will also be made available to you once a week to contact your families. Wait, what? I interrupt. Lark shoots me a look of disapproval, clearly not a fan of being cut off mid-sentence, but I can't help myself. What are pre-approved websites? Does that include email? Considering that you are all training and competing for a spot on the most important mission in history, Dr. Takumi and General Sokolov can't allow for any unnecessary distractions, she says tersely. So, that means email, texting, and all social media are off-limits at ISTC. However, those of you who are chosen for the final six will have full internet access at all times aboard the spacecraft. I stare at Lark in disbelief. I was counting on emailing my family every day, on having round-the-clock messages from Sam and my parents to hold on to whenever I missed them too much to breathe. That was supposed to be my one solace while we were apart. I should have guessed it wouldn't be that simple. We might as well be prisoners here. And I thought leaving my phone behind was tough, Asher says with a woeful shrug, but I'm not as able to let it go. So basically, we're restricted from contact with the rest of the world until the point at which we literally have to leave the world? I give Lark a desperate look, hoping she'll recognize how unfair this is. Maybe she can go to bat for us. Don't worry, Beckett says, his voice dripping with condescension. As soon as you get cut, you can go running back to posting selfies. I flash him a withering glare, and I'm just about to make a snappy comeback when Lark holds up her hands. Enough! Trust me when I say that you'll be so busy here, you won't even have the time or energy to go online. And now, if you'll follow me, there's more to see in this room. Lark leads the way past the stacks and into a lounge opening off the library, complete with leather armchairs, a projection screen, and a cabinet lined with DVDs. This is where most astronauts in training like to relax in the hour break between dinner and curfew, she says. And if you still haven't gotten your fill of space by the end of the day, we have all the movies you could want, even the old classics like Interstellar and Hidden Figures. What about Apollo 13? Katerina asks with a sly grin. Lark pauses. Yeah, believe it or not, we do have that one. She clears her throat. Okay, one last stop before I show you to your dorms. I follow Lark and my teammates out the door, still stewing over the iron-handed internet restrictions. Why was I the only one to object? Maybe my co-finalists are afraid to rock the boat, but how could they not care that we're being effectively shut off from the outside world? Plus, pre-approved websites sounds like just a fancy term for censorship. I'm willing to bet my life that Space Conspirator won't be on it, or any other site that doesn't further the Europa mission's agenda. This isn't the NASA I know, that I grew up worshipping. Then again, no one here is even pretending that it is. The ISTC has taken over, and that means a whole new set of rules. Once the seven of us are piled into the elevator, Lark presses the button for the top floor. Most of your time will be spent indoors, so Dr. Takumi has generously made the telescope tower available to the finalists during your downtime. It may be small, but it's my favorite spot on campus. The lift doors open to the outside heat. We follow Lark down a concrete pathway to a spiral staircase, which leads to the circular balcony above us. A tall sheet of plexiglass serves as a railing, making it impossible for anyone to fall or jump. And at the center of the tower is its namesake, a long and lean equatorial mount telescope pointed skyward. Cool, Leo murmurs, stepping up for a closer look. In the past, I would have been the first to run and peer into the lens. Ever since my grandparents bought me my first kid-sized telescope, showing me how I could see the same stars from my Los Angeles backyard that they once gazed up at in Iran, I've been entranced by them. But now, knowing how dangerously close I am to being sent up there, for the first time in my life, the sight of a telescope feels more like a warning. You can see some of the most distant planets and stars in our solar system from here, Lark says, including Europa. A shiver runs through me. There is something more than a little eerie about seeing the place where six of us will be forced to live and die, looming above as just a speck in the sky. Lark glances at her watch and then turns toward the stairs. All right, let's show you to your dorms. We make our way back to the Hab, and this time Lark turns in the opposite direction from the cafeteria and library. This new corridor is softer, with plush carpeting and rounded windows, colorful mission patches and photographs decorating the walls, and even the occasional accent table adorned with books on display. It's like crossing from an industrial space into a residential one. The girls' dorm is to the left, boys to the right, Lark says as we reach a fork in the corridor. There will be two of you to a room, and you'll find your rooming assignments posted on the door. My stomach nosedives at her words. It's not that I expected we'd each get our own room, but I certainly hoped. Lark leads us through the girls' dorm hallway, passing doors with plaques bearing the names of finalists from other teams, until we reach one belonging to us. Naomi Ardalan and Suki Chuan. I give Suki a small smile, wondering if she feels the way I do about rooming with a stranger. You have a couple hours to unpack and settle in before we meet back at the cafeteria for dinner. Lark reaches into her jacket pocket and hands us each a laminated pass. This serves as the key both to your room and the approved common areas. Make sure to keep it safe and remember, this pass won't open any doors beyond your own room and the spaces I just showed you. All other rooms, corridors, and buildings here at ISTC are off limits unless you are with me or another member of staff. That means absolutely no venturing to the mission floor, the labs, or anywhere else on your own. All that'll get you is the wrath of Dr. Takumi, which, trust me, you don't want to see. She looks intently at each of us. Do you understand? I join the others and nod obediently, but I can feel my heartbeat quickening. Why all the secrecy? Why are we confined to just four spaces on this massive campus? What are they hiding? The door closes behind us, plunging me and Suki into silence. For a few moments, we just stand there, both of us frozen in the awkwardness of the situation. But then I clear my throat, force myself to get a grip. I may not be much of a social butterfly, but I need a friend here. Maybe having a roommate will turn out for the best. So, what do you think about all this? I ask, realizing as the words come out of my mouth that I really do suck at making small talk. I think, she takes a shaky breath, and for a second I wonder if she's going to tell me something real, but then her expression closes up. I think we should try to get some rest while we can. We're going to be on an exhausting schedule. She strides forward and flicks on the lights. Our luggage is already here waiting for us, and Suki drags her bag to the bed farthest from the door, effectively claiming the quieter side of the room without asking me. But I have bigger things to worry about than a potentially inconsiderate roomie. I sink onto the bed on my side and glance around at our surroundings. The room is about what I expected, small and stark, with two twin beds, a pair of matching white desks and swivel chairs, and a closet and chest of drawers to share. The walls are bare, save for a large, sleek mirror near the door. At first, I'm surprised that the ISTC even bothered with such fancy mirrors in each room, and